realities of Crossfire Hurricane. You know, they still are so reluctant to go at Trump and look at this investigation goes directly at him because of what has happened in that first Trump term. And we really found there was a continuum over these 10 years that brought, you know, really impacted the time and how quickly they would investigate Trump.
And Carol.
I think the most shocking thing, it's hard to put it in one word, but I think the most shocking thing was how many brave, stubbornly brave people there were who tried to do the right thing and could not succeed in this institution that is built on doing the right thing without fear or favor.
We've been speaking with Carol Lenig and Aaron C. Davis, both Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporters. Their new book is out today. It's Injustice, How Politics and Fear Vanquished America's Justice Department. That does it for our show. I'll be in St. Louis on Friday, speaking in the Q&A after the film Steal This Story, Please, plays in two theaters in St. Louis. Check our website at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
Bye.
What does the average KBOO listener think of self-help radio?
This is so hard and complicated.
I have no idea what it is.
What's this old-time music?
I feel so proud of myself.
It seems kind of worthless.
Why does it have to make so much noise?
It sounds very hipster.
That's the worst thing.
Look at how humanity has used their intellect.
Self-Help Radio, a different theme explored with music and talk every week. Tuesdays, midnight to 3 a.m. on KBOO Portland.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from 988 Oregon, a public service helping those who are stressed, worried, or just feeling down when they call or text 988. Support is confidential, and call takers are real people in Oregon who speak with understanding and respect. More info at 988oregon.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a suspect is arrested in connection to the fire that burned Portland City Councilor Candace Avalos' house. Special election ballots are due by 8 p.m. tonight. And budget woes mean Multnomah County will pause its housing voucher program. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 4th, 2025. I'm Eric Leuschner. Portland police arrest a man in connection to the fire at City Councilor Candace Avalos' house on October 26th. Vashon Locust, 51, is charged with misdemeanor reckless burning and two counts of second-degree criminal mischief. Police say Locust entered a shed near Avalos' house to use an electric outlet for a heater. When the outlet didn't work, he lit a small fire that grew to consume her car and carport and damage her house. Early reports from fire investigators said they found the fire suspicious in nature, and Avalos's highlighted a threatening email she received 4 days before the fire at her house. It said, quote, "I hope the entire state burns and your house is the first one to go," end quote. It referenced the resolution adopted by City Council to denounce National Guard deployment to the city. OPB found, through public records, that the threat is unrelated since the email was sent from Maryland. Today is Election Day. Ballots are due in drop boxes by 8 p.m. It's an off-year special election, meaning there are fewer things for voters to consider. Portland voters are weighing an increase to the Portland Parks Levy, something parks advocates say is critical to the future of the city's park system. That money would go for parks programming like swim lessons, summer camps, and sports programs, while allowing the Parks Bureau to offer free or reduced-cost programs to low-income users. The levy also covers some maintenance work, including trash pickup and tree planting. The levy cannot pay for major maintenance projects like replacing a community center roof or repairing a playground. The November ballot measure increases the current levy taxing rate from 80 cents per $1,000 of assessed value to $1.40. That nearly 75% increase would raise an estimated $84 million in the first year. But this newer levy mostly pays for parks programming and classes, with only 2% going to maintenance. If the measure fails, the city estimates the Parks Bureau will lose nearly half its annual operating budget. Portland City Councilor Dan Ryan has come out against the parks levy, despite voting for it to be sent to the ballot earlier this year. Elsewhere in Oregon, voters in Gladstone are considering whether the city should be annexed into Clackamas Fire District for emergency services. The fire district has been serving Gladstone since 2022 under a temporary service contract. Before that contract, Gladstone said it was difficult to staff its own small fire department. Voters in the Lake Oswego School District will vote on whether to authorize over $200 million in bonds for upgrading school infrastructure with new fire alarms and earthquake preparedness. Washington County voters will decide on an extension of their library service levy at a rate of 37 cents per $1,000 of assessed value. Voters in Jackson County might decide to increase the lodging tax in Medford to pay for a dedicated conference center. Ballots are due by 8 p.m. tonight. Ballot drop box locations can be found online through each county's elections website. Tribes are working to respond to SNAP cuts, which are often an essential service for Native households. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Navajo Nation is bracing for the gap in SNAP benefits. It's yet another food insecurity problem for tribal members living on the sprawling reservation. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has more.
With only a dozen or so stores throughout the nation, buying groceries is already a daily struggle. But letting benefits lapse could make their dilemma much worse. A third of Navajo households depend on SNAP today. Thomas Cody is with the Navajo Division of Child and Family Services.
We're 400,000 strong, and we can get through this together.
Meanwhile, the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma has declared a state of emergency
due to this federally imposed food crisis.
Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. made almost $7 million available. As for the Navajo Nation, Cody says it's unclear whether they'll follow suit.
We're coordinating right now with our legislatures and our executive branch. And I don't know if it will be a declaration, but we're exploring all avenues to assist our people.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
On Monday, the Cherokee Nation announced the expansion of its Emergency Cash Assistance Program to all Cherokee Nation citizens on SNAP nationwide. The tribe says it will adjust payments as the federal government partially pays benefits in November. The deadline to apply is November 14th. In a recent ceremony, clan leaders and carvers dedicated the latest pole in Sealaska Heritage Institute's Kutia Dei Juno's Totem Pole Trail. KTOO's Yvonne Crumry has more.
Inside the clan house in the Walter Soboff building, Suktinady clan members stand in front of a large poster depicting a totem pole that represents their clan history. They offer thanks to other clans, carvers, and SHI leadership. The actual pole, called Akutia and Tlingit, was raised near Juno's Overstreet Park, but organizers held the dedication inside due to weather. Edward Thomas is Suktinady, and he says he's excited to see his clan join the handful of others already represented by the Kutia Dei.
As I look at the walk of the totem pole along the waterfront here, I'm proud to see that all of our clans are being represented.
Thomas went on to thank the carver, Lee Wallace, and his apprentices for the thought and work they put into the pole. Wallace is a Haida master carver and lives in Saxman. But he says this Kutia is a part of his family's legacy, too.
My great-grandfather has a totem pole in the state building, Dwight Wallace. My grandfather, John Wallace, has a totem pole that was outside the city museum. So now with this particular Kutia pole, there's three generations of Wallace totem poles standing here in Juneau.
Wallace was helped by apprentices, including his son, Charles Peel. And Peel holds the youngest member of the carving team, his five-year-old daughter, Dodd Senga Elizabeth, as he describes the design of the pole.
And at the top, we have the current clan leaders,
We want to acknowledge that this is the representation of a living people, that this isn't just something that's from the past. This is something that's tying history together. We often look at totem poles as things that are coming back from the past, and we wanted to add a piece that represents the present.
Below the current clan leaders, the pole features a spirit man, raven, and a box that represents the abundance of knowledge and history held in the Sukhtanedi clan, whose homelands are near Cake. At the base is the clan crest, dog salmon swimming in tall grasses. The National Park Service funded this pole. SHI plans to raise a total of 30 poles along Juneau's waterfront. So far, 13 poles have been installed. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Cromery.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Multnomah County will pause any new housing vouchers after losing state funding. The county's Homeless Services Department has a bigger funding gap than expected since needed state resources didn't get passed. 700 people won't get new vouchers from the city this year. The voucher helps to cover most or all of their rent. The county will also pause its rapid rehousing program. Rapid rehousing programs move people from shelters directly into housing. County data shows that 82% of people who've used those rapid rehousing programs have remained housed after 2 years. The change at the county comes at a time of some conflict with city policy and priorities on homelessness. Portland is spending considerable funds on Mayor Wilson's overnight shelter bed plan, nearly half of which are sitting empty night to night. Wilson also announced he would start enforcing the city's camping ban on November 1st. Under that ban, people sleeping outside can be jailed or fined $100 if they don't accept alternate accommodations like Wilson's overnight shelters. Californians vote on a constitutional amendment for mid-decade redistricting. The Trump administration will partially fund SNAP benefits. And immigrants' advocates worry about racial profiling amid intensified immigration raids. With those stories and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We have made a decision. We're going to win, and we're going to win big.
Former Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi is rallying for California's Proposition 50, also called the Election Rigging Response Act. The state constitutional amendment backed by Democrats would allow mid-decade congressional redistricting after Texas redrew district maps at the request of President Donald Trump. Polls suggest it'll pass, but good government groups are frustrated to see a nationwide gerrymandering arms race. The campaign for mayor of New York could define the future of the Democratic Party. Party nominee and Democratic Socialist Zohran Mamdani is leading in spite of ads attacking his inexperience and progressive positions. His primary opponent, former Governor Andrew Cuomo, is running as a third-party candidate. Cuomo calls himself a safer choice, saying Trump will send in the National Guard if Mamdani wins.
We need to clean up the city. We need a better public school system. We need more police to keep us safe on the streets. And we need to be able to stand up to Donald Trump and fight for New York.
But the president just endorsed Cuomo in a 60 Minutes interview, saying he prefers a, quote, bad Democrat to a communist. Mamdani congratulated Cuomo for getting Trump's endorsement. In that interview, Trump insisted he didn't know a crypto billionaire he recently pardoned. Critics charge the president's family has had extensive dealings with the Chinese-born founder of Binance, who was found guilty of money laundering and financial crimes. Polls show the Democratic candidates for governor in New Jersey and Virginia are leading, though the New Jersey race could be close. GOP senators have just blocked a bill to fully fund SNAP food benefits. The White House says it will partially fund the program this month after two judges ordered it to use a contingency fund for that purpose. But the administration says dispersing the money could take weeks, and funds ran out on the first, leaving states and food banks scrambling. Brandon McKinley with Denver Food Pantry Metro Caring says SNAP is crucial for the working poor.
We are talking people that are working really hard, sometimes one or two jobs, and still are making such a small amount of money that paying for food is out of the question when they're also looking at paying for rent that keeps raising year over year.
The Department of Homeland Security is touting Operation Midway Blitz. Since it began in September, more than 3,000 people have been swept up in the Midwest. DHS Secretary Kristi Noem says they're not arresting citizens.
There's no American citizens have been arrested or detained. We focus on those that are here illegally. And anything that you would hear or report different than that is simply not true and false reporting.
But that directly contradicts a ProPublica investigation, which found ICE arrested or detained more than 170 U.S. citizens in the last year, some during raids in Chicago. Edward Vargas with the Brookings Institution is one of those who say Latinos are being profiled by racially charged enforcement not limited to undocumented immigrants. And he says he and his family know from personal history to be afraid. afraid.
When I was a child, I had a cousin who died in police custody. My worry about being around a cop, I don't feel safe. This kind of exacerbates this feelings of you're not here to protect me. You're here to do something bad to me.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KABU News in depth. We'll get a preview of the Portland Book Festival, and later we'll speak with Professor Ray Coe Hillier on a new documentary that followed her college class taught jointly to undergraduates and incarcerated students at Columbia River Correctional Institution. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be rainy with an overnight low of 46 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy as well with a high of 60. Today in history, California voted to pass Proposition 8, which banned same-sex marriage in 2008. Earlier that year, the California Supreme Court ruled that a state ban on same-sex marriage is unconstitutional. The ban was soon overturned, and same-sex marriage was made legal nationwide in 2015. The quote of the day is from gender nonconforming author and performance artist and activist Alok Ved Menon. In their memoir, Beyond the Gender Binary, they write, quote, "We want a world where boys can feel, girls can lead, and the rest of us can not only exist, but thrive. This is not about erasing men and women, but rather acknowledging that man and woman are two of many stars in the constellation that do not compete, but amplify one another's shine." Scientists from UCLA, UC Davis, Harvard, and the University of Texas, Austin are crunching data from a sniffer van that analyzes toxic smoke after the wildfires in LA. The aftermath of the fires brings a number of concerns about long-term health impacts. Suzanne Potter has more.
Cutting-edge technology deployed in the wake of the LA fires is helping scientists understand the nature of the toxic smoke from urban wildfires. Researchers from UCLA, UC Davis, Harvard, and the University of Texas at Austin deployed what they call a sniffer van in the Pacific Palisades and Altadena for several weeks in February and May to measure air pollution in the burn zone. Chemist Paavo Mishtal, a professor at UT Austin, is using a supercomputer to analyze reams of data to identify hotspots and understand how different sources contribute to air pollution.
With every second, we see more than 1,000 different chemicals and how they change over time. So this novel way of mapping chemistry from an electric mobile van is game-changing.
Mishtal is part of the Los Angeles Fire Human Exposure and Long-Term Health Study, also known as LA Fire Health. Experts believe that toxins released in urban wildfires are potentially more carcinogenic and deadlier than smoke from other wildfires. The LA Fire Health team noticed people digging through the remnants of burned properties without proper protective equipment, breathing toxic airborne particles. Mishtal hopes this research will help local authorities guide residents as they return after future disasters.
Dilution is the solution to pollution in a way. The community needs to know when it is safe to ventilate and when it is not.
He advises homeowners to let the professionals handle remediation after a fire. They should open up and ventilate once the outdoor air has cleared, and he says people should remove anything that burned, especially from inside the house, because it can still off-gas chemicals and pollute the air for months. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Open enrollment for Medicare lasts until December 7th this year, and experts are urging Washingtonians to pay attention to their plans to make sure they are still covered. Medicare can be complicated, but volunteers from the Statewide Health Insurance Benefits Advisors, or SHIBA, program are available to help. Isabel Charlet has the details.
It is Medicare open enrollment season until December 7th, and experts are urging Washingtonians to engage with the process to avoid surprise price increases or loss of coverage. Washington's statewide health insurance benefits advisors program, known as SHIBA, provides free, unbiased support to people applying or updating their Medicare. SHIBA program manager Tim Smolin says his message this year is to pay attention, even if you have been enrolled in Medicare for years.
I can guarantee something is changing that you care about. That might be your plan is exiting the market, or you have a rate increase for the monthly premium, or you're going to pay more for your prescription drugs.
This year, SHIBA introduced the Medicare Jumpstart Toolkit to help people through the steps of applying. People can visit insurance.wa.gov or call 1-800-562-6900 to set up an appointment with a SHIBA volunteer. Jean Matheson has been volunteering for SHIBA in Washington State for 10 years. She says if you are feeling overwhelmed or confused by Medicare, you are not alone. She advises everyone to make sure their doctors and prescriptions are still covered under their plan and warns against making decisions based on what others are doing.
Every January, we see people come in to see us who didn't realize that the plan that worked so well for them the prior year maybe won't even cover some of their drugs in the new year, and it's too late to make a change at that point.
Matheson adds that people who are low income, especially if they make less than about $1,800 a month, may qualify for programs that can reduce the cost of their premiums. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
As federal deportation efforts intensify, a new report warns that essential safety net programs are at financial risk. The analysis from the Economic Policy Institute finds that losing immigrant workers who pay into the system threatens the sustainability of Social Security and Medicare. Chermel Gomes has more in Mississippi.
A push for mass deportations could have unintended consequences for Mississippi's economy and retirees. Programs like Social Security and Medicare rely on taxes from today's workers to pay benefits to today's retirees. With a declining birth rate and a wave of baby boomer retirements, a new report finds immigrant workers are crucial to filling that gap. Josh Bivens, the report's author, says that without them, the state's economic engine slows.
It does make things like Social Security and Medicare a little harder to sustain. If we have a steady flow of younger immigrant workers coming in, that just makes it much easier to sustain those really important social insurance programs.
According to the report, the U.S.-born labor force is expected to shrink over the next decade. In Mississippi, immigrants comprise 3% of the workforce and are pivotal in sectors like agriculture, where they make up over 40% of fishing and forestry workers. Nationally, over 1.2 million immigrants left the labor force in the first half of 2025, according to Pew Research Center analysis. The report challenges the notion that immigrants take jobs from U.S.-born workers, citing research that they actually create more jobs and can lead to higher wages. Bivens points to the construction industry as an example of how the workforce is interconnected.
The really immigrant-heavy part of residential construction is maybe the framing and digging out the foundation. Well, if that doesn't get done, the part of construction that is more intensive in the use of U.S.-born workers, like maybe the electrician and the plumber, they can't do their work.
The report found that beyond construction, immigrants are essential to Mississippi's manufacturing and service industries. Nationally, they account for nearly a fifth of the total workforce, 30% of construction workers, and 24% of service industry workers. This is Tremel Gomes from Mississippi News Connection.
The Trump-Xi Jinping meeting in South Korea produced modest agreements on key trade issues, such as Chinese exports of rare earth minerals and U.S. exports to China of advanced technology. But the devil is in the details, and each country's report differs considerably on them. As one observer notes, it might not be too long before serious trade tensions re-emerge. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. The much-awaited meeting in Korea between President Trump and President Xi Jinping promised, according to Trump, a major trade deal. The Chinese seemed prepared to offer much less. In remarks to Trump, Xi repeated Chinese refrains about the need for cooperation, stressed that the business relationship is the anchor and driving force in China-U.S. relations, and expressed confidence that inevitable frictions could be overcome. Xi also made clear that China's economy is strong. Quote, "We have the confidence and capability to navigate all kinds of risks and challenges," he said. In other words, China is not in any kind of economic trouble that might make it susceptible to outside pressure. A cycle of mutual retaliation, he said, is unacceptable. Mutual retaliation was avoided this time, but the accomplishments at the Xi-Trump meeting were modest. According to China's summary, Xi promised to resume purchases of U.S. soybeans for 3 years, place more Chinese controls on fentanyl in return for a lowering of the U.S. tariff related to fentanyl, and suspend China's regulations on rare earth exports for 1 year in exchange for U.S. suspension of restrictions on advanced technology exports to China. As always in these exchanges, the devil is in the details, and the details in the U.S. fact sheet on the meeting diverge considerably from China's. First, on Chinese soybean purchases, whereas the U.S. specifies the quantity of soybeans China has committed to buy from now through 2028, China's reporting has no figures and could be far less than Trump is trumpeting. The U.S. fact sheet also notes China's promise to purchase or end tariffs on numerous U.S. products, from dairy to fruits and cotton. China's readout doesn't mention any of them. By the way, American farmers' common reaction to the deal, according to press reports, is that it doesn't solve anything, since the promised purchases are no greater than before, and farmers also face, because of Trump's tariffs, higher costs for machinery, fertilizer, and seeds. Second, the crucial issue of China's rare earth minerals exports has by no means been resolved with the Trump-Xi meeting. According to the U.S. readout, China will eliminate all the regulations on those minerals that were enacted starting in 2022, and not just controls imposed this year. Such a comprehensive removal may not be what China either promised or intended. Third, the agreement leaves unclear what technology exports to China will actually be allowed. Most importantly, whether the latest NVIDIA chips, which experts believe would be a strategic mistake to sell to China, will be available. The House Select Committee on China recently warned on social media that selling advanced chips to China, quote, would be akin to giving Iran weapons-grade uranium. Fourth, on fentanyl, the U.S. says, quote, China will stop the shipment of certain designated chemicals to North America and strictly control exports of certain other chemicals to all destinations in the world. That is quite a promise, and if China actually made it, it is hard to see how the promise can be fulfilled. Fifth, questions remain about what the U.S. and Chinese average tariff rates will be as a result of the Trump-Xi meeting. The U.S. seems to expect that China's tariffs on many U.S. imports will be removed or suspended. Various reports indicate that U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods will still be very high, 47%. The lack of clarity on this issue may affect how much rare earth minerals the Chinese sell to the U.S. or how much U.S. agricultural products they actually buy. And sixth, the U.S. fact sheet mentions China's agreement to, quote, terminate its various investigations targeting U.S. companies in the semiconductor supply chain, including its antitrust, anti-monopoly, and anti-dumping investigations, unquote. China's readout does not mention such an agreement. Two other kinds of issues important to U.S.-China relations were apparently not addressed. One is future areas of cooperation. Xi Jinping offered a modest menu of joint projects for future dialogue, combating illegal immigration and telecom fraud, anti-money laundering, artificial intelligence, and responding to infectious diseases. Trump's response, if any, was not reported. Then there are key policy differences that apparently were not brought up at the meeting: China's support of Russia in the Ukraine war, and the U.S. commitment to Taiwan's defense. Taiwan's leadership has to be relieved, since some observers were saying that Trump might sacrifice support of Taiwan to gain a comprehensive trade agreement. In sum, we can credit the meeting with having eased U.S.-China trade tensions by focusing on the key areas of disagreement and putting off a trade war that would benefit no one. On the other hand, the meeting really kicked the can down the road. Promises made and not kept will revive tensions before too long, just as they did in Trump's first term and under Joe Biden's term. The bottom line is that the basis for mutual mistrust has not been addressed and is highly unlikely to be addressed until a new set of leaders emerges in both countries. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 4, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov, J. Josh Salem, Ken Jones, and Karen James. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Suzanne Potter, and Tramel Gomes. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Full Omath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We'll get a preview of the Portland Book Festival, and later we'll speak with Professor Reiko Hillier on a new documentary that followed her college class taught jointly to undergraduates and incarcerated students at Columbia River Correctional Institution. Thank you.